Even as workers loaded the platform, it sank 8 inches. Over the next 4 days, it settled 30 inches more and would have continued sinking if the engineers had not simply called off the test. Of course, nearly all the soil of Jackson Park was competent to support floating foundations, except the one portion destined to bear the fair's biggest and heaviest building. Here, Burnham realized, contractors would have to drive piles at least down to Hardpan, an expensive complication and a source of additional delay. The problems with this building, however, had only just begun. In April 1891, Chicago learned the results of the latest mayoral election. In the city's richest clubs, industrialists gathered to toast the fact that Carter Henry Harrison, whom they viewed as overly sympathetic to organized labor, had lost to Hempstead Washburn, a Republican. Burnham, too, allowed himself a moment of celebration. To him, Harrison represented the old Chicago of filth, smoke, and vice, everything the fair was designed to repudiate. The celebrations were tempered, however, by the fact that Harrison had lost by the narrowest of margins, fewer than 4,000 votes, and what's more, had achieved this near victory without the support of a major party. Shunned by the Democrats, he had run as an independent. Elsewhere in the city, Patrick Prendergast grieved. Harrison was his hero, his hope. The margin was so narrow, however, that he believed if Harrison ran again, he would win. Prendergast resolved to double his own efforts to help Harrison succeed. In Jackson Park, Burnham faced repeated interruptions stemming from his de facto role as ambassador to the outside world, charged with cultivating goodwill and future attendance. Mostly these banquets, talks, and tours were time-squandering annoyances, as in June 1891, when, at the request of Director General Davis, Burnham hosted a visit to Jackson Park by a battalion of foreign dignitaries that consumed 2 full days. Others were purely a pleasure. A few weeks earlier, Thomas Edison, known widely as the Wizard of Menlo Park, had paid a visit to Burnham's shanty. Burnham showed him around. Edison suggested the exposition use incandescent bulbs rather than arc lights, because the incandescent variety produced a softer light. Where arc lights could not be avoided, he said, they should be covered with white globes. And, of course, Edison urged the fair to use direct current, DC, the prevailing standard. The civility of this encounter belied a caustic battle being waged outside Jackson Park for the rights to illuminate the exposition. On one side was General Electric Company, which was created when J.P. Morgan took over Edison's company and merged it with several others, and which now proposed to install a direct current system to light the fair. On the other side was Westinghouse Electric Company, with a bid to wire Jackson Park for alternating current, using patents its founder, George Westinghouse, had acquired a few years earlier from Nikola Tesla. General Electric offered to do the job for $1.8 million, insisting the deal would not earn a penny's profit. A number of exposition directors held General Electric stock and urged William Baker, president of the fair since Lyman Gage's April retirement, to accept the bid. Baker refused, calling it extortionate. General Electric rather miraculously came back with a bid of $554,000. But Westinghouse, whose AC system was inherently cheaper and more efficient, bid $399,000. The exposition went with Westinghouse and helped change the history of electricity. The source of Burnham's greatest dismay was the failure of the architects to finish their drawings on schedule. If he had once been obsequious to Richard Hunt and the Eastern Men, he was not now. In a June 2, 1891 letter to Hunt, he wrote, "We are at a dead standstill waiting for your scale drawings. Can't we have them as they are and finish here? 4 days later, he again prodded Hunt. The delay you are causing us by not forwarding scale drawings is embarrassing in the extreme. To Peabody. We are completely put out with the delay on your building. That same month, a serious, if unavoidable, interruption hobbled the landscape department. Olmsted became ill. Severely so. He attributed his condition to poisoning from an arsenic-based pigment called turkey red in the wallpaper of his Brookline home. It may, however, simply have been another bout of deep blue melancholia, the kind that had assailed him off and on for years. During his recuperation, Olmsted ordered bulbs and plants for cultivation in two large nurseries established on the fairgrounds. He ordered Dusty Miller, Carpet Bugle, President Garfield Heliotrope, Speedwell, Pennyroyal, English and Algerian ivies, verbena, vinca, and a rich palette of geraniums, among them Black Prince, Christopher Columbus, Mrs. Turner, Crystal Palace, Happy Thought, and Jeanne d'Arc. He dispatched an army of collectors to the shores of Lake Calumet, where they gathered 27 train car loads of iris, sedge, bulrush, and other semi-aquatic plants and grasses. They collected an additional 4,000 crates of pond lily roots, which Olmsted's men quickly planted, only to watch most of the roots succumb to the ever-changing levels of the lake. In contrast to the lush growth within the nurseries, the grounds of the park had been scraped free of all vegetation. Workers enriched the soil with 1,000 carloads of manure shipped from the Union stockyards, and another 2,000 collected from the horses working in Jackson Park. So much exposed earth and manure became a problem. It was bad enough during the hot weather when a south wind could blind the eyes of man and beast, wrote Rudolf Ulrich, Olmsted's landscape superintendent at the park, but still worse during wet weather, the newly filled ground, which was still undrained, becoming soaked with water. Horses sank to their bellies. It was midsummer 1891 by the time the last of the architect's drawings was completed. As each set came in, Burnham advertised for bids. Recognizing that the architect's delays had put everything behind schedule, he inserted into the construction contracts clauses that made him a czar, as the Chicago Tribune put it. Each contract contained a tight deadline for completion, with a financial penalty for every day beyond. Burnham had advertised the first contract on May 14th, this for the mines and mining building. He wanted it finished by the end of the year. That left, at best, about 7 months for construction, roughly the amount of time a 21st century homeowner would need to build a new garage. He is the arbiter of all disputes, and no provision is made for an appeal from his decision, the Tribune reported. If, in the opinion of Mr. Burnham, the builder is not employing a sufficient force of men to complete the work on time, Mr. Burnham is authorized to engage men himself and charge the cost to the builder. The mines building was the first of the main exposition buildings to begin construction, but the work did not start until July 3, 1891, with less than 16 months remaining until dedication day. As construction of the buildings at last got underway, anticipation outside the park began to increase. Colonel William Cody, Buffalo Bill, sought a concession for his Wild West show, newly returned from a hugely successful tour of Europe, but the fair's Committee on Ways and Means turned him down on grounds of incongruity. Undeterred, Cody secured rights to a large parcel of land adjacent to the park. In San Francisco, a 21-year-old entrepreneur named Saul Bloom realized the Chicago Fair would let him, at last, take advantage of an asset he had acquired in Paris 2 years earlier. Entranced by the Algerian village at the Paris Exposition, he had bought the rights to display the village and its inhabitants at future events. The Ways and Means Committee rejected him, too. He returned to San Francisco intent on trying a different, more oblique means of winning a concession, one that ultimately would get him a lot more than he had bargained for. Meanwhile, young Lieutenant Shufeld had reached Zanzibar. On July 20th, he telegraphed Exposition President William Baker that he was confident he could acquire as many pygmies from the Congo as he wished, provided the King of Belgium consented. "President Baker wants these pygmies," the Tribune said, "and so does everybody else around headquarters." On the drafting board, the fair did look spectacular. The centerpiece was the Grand Court, which everyone had begun calling the Court of Honor. With its immense palaces by Hunt, Post, Peabody, and the rest, the court by itself would be a marvel. But now nearly every state in the nation was planning a building, as were some 200 companies and foreign governments. The exposition promised to surpass the Paris Exposition on every level. Every level, that is, except one. And that persistent deficit troubled Burnham. The fair still had nothing planned that would equal, let alone eclipse, the Eiffel Tower. At nearly 1,000 feet in height, the tower remained the tallest structure in the world and an insufferable reminder of the triumph of the Paris Exposition. To out-Eiffel Eiffel had become a battle cry among the directors. A competition held by the Tribune brought a wave of implausible proposals. C.F. Richel of Bridgeport, Connecticut, suggested a tower with a base 100 feet high by 500 feet wide, within which Richel proposed to nest a second tower, and in this one, a third. At intervals, a complicated system of hydraulic tubes and pumps would cause the towers to telescope slowly upward, a journey of several hours, then allow them to sink slowly back to their original configuration. The top of the tower would house a restaurant, although possibly a bordello would have been more apt. Another inventor, J.B. McComber, representing the Chicago Tower Spiral Spring Ascension and Toboggan Transportation Company, proposed a tower with a height of 8,947 feet, nearly nine times the height of the Eiffel Tower, with a base 1,000 feet in diameter sunk 2,000 feet into the earth. Elevated rails would lead from the top of the tower all the way to New York, Boston, Baltimore, and other cities. Visitors ready to conclude their visit to the fair and daring enough to ride elevators to the top would then toboggan all the way back home. "As the cost of the tower and its slides is of secondary importance," McComber noted, "I do not mention it here, but will furnish figures upon application." A third proposal demanded even more courage from visitors. This inventor, who gave his initials as RTE, envisioned a tower 4,000 feet tall, from which he proposed to hang a 2,000-foot cable of best rubber. Attached at the bottom end of this cable would be a car seating 200 people. The car and its passengers would be shoved off a platform and fall without restraint to the end of the cable, where the car would snap back upward and continue bouncing until it came to a stop. The engineer urged that, as a precaution, the ground be covered with 8 feet of feather bedding. Everyone was thinking in terms of towers, but Burnham, for one, did not think a tower was the best approach. Eiffel had done it first and best. More than merely tall, his tower was grace frozen in iron, as much an evocation of the spirit of the age as Chartres had been in its time. To build a tower would be to follow Eiffel into territory he already had conquered for France. In August 1891, Eiffel himself telegraphed the directors to ask if he might submit a proposal for a tower. This was a surprise, and at first, a welcome one. Exposition President Baker immediately cabled Eiffel that the directors would be delighted to see whatever he proposed. "If the fair was to have a tower," Baker said in an interview, "Monsieur Eiffel is the man to build it. It would not be so much of an experiment if he should be in charge of its construction. He might be able to improve on his design for the Eiffel Tower in Paris, and I think it fair to assume that he would not construct one in any way inferior to that famous structure." To the engineers of America, however, this was a slap in the face. Over the next week and a half, telegrams shot from city to city, engineer to engineer, until the story became somewhat distorted. Suddenly it seemed as if an Eiffel Tower in Chicago was a certainty, that Eiffel himself was to do the out-Eiffeling. The engineers were outraged. A long letter of protest arrived at Burnham's office, signed by some of the nation's leading engineers. Acceptance of the distinguished gentleman's offer, they wrote, would be equivalent to a statement that the great body of civil engineers in this country, whose noble works attest their skill abroad as well as throughout the length and breadth of the land, lack the ability to cope with such a problem, and such action could have a tendency to rob them of their just claim to professional excellence. Burnham read this letter with approval. It pleased him to see America's civil engineers at last expressing passion for the fair, although in fact the directors had promised nothing to Eiffel. His formal proposal arrived a week later, envisioning a tower that was essentially a taller version of what he had built in Paris. The directors sent his proposal out for translation, reviewed it, then graciously turned it down. If there was to be a tower at the fair, it would be an American tower. For now, however, the drafting boards of America's engineers were dishearteningly barren. Saul Bloom, back in California, took his quest for a concession for his Algerian village to an influential San Franciscan, Mike DeYoung, publisher of the San Francisco Chronicle and one of the exposition's national commissioners. Bloom told him about the rights he had acquired in Paris and how the exposition had rebuffed his petition. DeYoung knew Bloom. As a teenager, Bloom had worked in DeYoung's Alcazar Theater and worked his way up to become its treasurer at age 19. In his spare time, Bloom had organized the ushers, checkers, and refreshment sellers into a more efficient, cohesive structure that greatly increased the theater's profits and his own salary. Next, he organized these functions at other theaters and received regular commissions from each. At the Alcazar, he inserted into scripts the names of popular products, bars, and restaurants, including the Cliff House, and for this received another stream of income. He also organized a cadre of professional applauders known as a claque to provide enthusiastic ovations, demand encores, and cry brava for any performer willing to pay. Most performers did pay, even the most famous diva of the time, Adelina Patti. One day Bloom saw an item in a theatrical publication about a novel Mexican band that he believed Americans would adore, and convinced their manager to let him bring the band north for a tour. Bloom's profit was $40,000. At the time, he was only 18. DeYoung told Bloom he would investigate the situation. 1 week later, he summoned Bloom back to his office. "How soon could you be ready to go to Chicago?" he asked. Bloom, startled, said, "In a couple of days, I guess." He assumed DeYoung had arranged a second opportunity for him to petition the fair's Ways and Means Committee. He was hesitant and told DeYoung he saw no value in making the journey until the exposition's directors had a better idea of the kinds of attractions they wanted. "The situation has advanced since our talk," DeYoung said. "All we need now is somebody to take charge." He gave Bloom a cable from the exposition company that empowered DeYoung to hire someone to manage the Midway Plaisance. "You've been elected," he said. "I can't do it," Bloom said. He did not want to leave San Francisco. "Even if I did, I've got too much at stake here to consider it." DeYoung watched him. "I don't want to hear another word from you till tomorrow," he said. In the meantime, DeYoung wanted Bloom to think about how much money he would have to be paid to overcome his reluctance. "When you come back, you can name your salary," he said. "I will either accept or reject it. There will be no argument. Is that agreeable?" Bloom did agree, but only because DeYoung's request gave him a graceful way of refusing the job. All he had to do, he figured, was name such an outrageous sum that DeYoung could not possibly accept it. And as I walked down the street, I decided what it would be. Burnham tried to anticipate every conceivable threat to the fair. Aware of Chicago's reputation for vice and violence, Burnham insisted on the creation of a large police force, the Columbian Guard, and placed it under the command of Colonel Edmund Rice, a man of great valor who had faced Pickett's charge at Gettysburg. Unlike conventional police departments, the Guard's mandate explicitly emphasized the novel idea of preventing crime, rather than merely arresting wrongdoers after the fact. Disease, too, posed dangers to the fair, Burnham knew. An outbreak of smallpox or cholera or any of the other lethal infections that roamed the city could irreparably taint the exposition and destroy any hopes the directors had of achieving the record attendance necessary to generate a profit. By now, the new science of bacteriology pioneered by Robert Koch and Louis Pasteur had convinced most public health officials that contaminated drinking water caused the spread of cholera and other bacterial diseases. Chicago's water teemed with bacteria, thanks mainly to the Chicago River. In a monumental spasm of civic engineering, the city in 1871 reversed the river's direction so that it no longer flowed into Lake Michigan, but ran instead into the Des Plaines River and ultimately into the Mississippi, the theory being that the immense flows of both rivers would dilute the sewage to harmless levels, a concept downriver towns like Joliet did not wholeheartedly embrace. To the engineer's surprise, however, prolonged rains routinely caused the Chicago River to regress and again pour dead cats and fecal matter into the lake, and in such volume that tendrils of black water reached all the way to the intake cribs of the city water system. Most Chicago residents had no choice but to drink the water. Burnham, however, believed from the start that the fair's workers and visitors needed a better, safer supply. In this, too, he was ahead of the age. On his orders, his sanitary engineer, William S. McHarg, built a water sterilization plant on the fairgrounds, which pumped lake water through a succession of large cedar tanks in which the water was aerated and boiled. McHarg's men set big casks of the sterilized water throughout the park and replenished the casks every day. Burnham planned to close the purification plant by opening day and give visitors a choice between two other supplies of safe water: lake water, purified with Pasteur filters and offered free of charge, or naturally pure water for a penny a cup, piped 100 miles from the coveted springs of Waukesha, Wisconsin. In November 1891, Burnham ordered McHarg to investigate 5 of Waukesha's springs to gauge their capacity and purity, but to do so quietly, suggesting he was aware that running a pipeline through the village's comely landscape might prove a sensitive issue. No one, however, could have imagined that in a few months McHarg's efforts to secure a supply of Waukesha's best would lead to an armed encounter in the middle of a fine Wisconsin night. What most worried Burnham was fire. The loss of the Granis block with his and Root's headquarters remained a vivid, humiliating memory. A catastrophic fire in Jackson Park could destroy the fair. Yet within the park, fire was central to the construction process. Plasterers used small furnaces called salamanders to speed drying and curing. Tinners and electricians used fire pots for melting, bending, and fusing. Even the fire department used fire. Steam engines powered the pumps on the department's horse-drawn fire trucks. Burnham established defenses that by prevailing standards seemed elaborate, even excessive. He formed an exposition fire department and ordered the installation of hundreds of fire hydrants and telegraphic alarm boxes. He commissioned the construction of a fireboat, the Fire Queen, built specifically to negotiate the park's shallow canals and to pass under its many low bridges. Design specifications required that every building be surrounded with an underwater main and plumbed with interior standpipes. He also banned all smoking on the grounds, although here he made at least 2 exceptions. one for a contractor who pleaded that his crew of European artisans would quit if denied their cigars, the other for the big hearth in his shanty, around which he and his engineers, draftsmen, and visiting architects gathered each night for wine, talk, and cigars. With the onset of winter, Burnham ordered all hydrants packed in horse manure to prevent freezing. On the coldest days, the manure steamed as if the hydrants themselves were on fire. When Saul Bloom returned to the office of Mike DeYoung, he was confident DeYoung could not possibly accept his salary request, for he had decided to ask for the same salary as the President of the United States, $50,000. "The more I thought about it," Bloom recalled, "the more I enjoyed the prospect of telling Mike DeYoung that no less a sum could compensate me for my sacrifice in leaving San Francisco." DeYoung offered Bloom a seat. His expression was sober and expectant. Bloom said, "Much as I appreciate the compliment, I find that my interests lie right here in this city. As I look ahead, I can see myself..." DeYoung cut him off. Softly, he said, "Now, Saul, I thought you were going to tell me how much you wanted us to pay you." "I didn't want you to think I didn't appreciate." "You said that a minute ago," DeYoung said. "Now tell me how much money you want." This was not going quite the way Bloom had expected. With some trepidation, Bloom told him the number. $1,000 a week." DeYoung smiled. "Well, that's pretty good pay for a fellow of 21. But I have no doubt you'll earn it." In August, Burnham's chief structural engineer, Abraham Gottlieb, made a startling disclosure. He had failed to calculate wind loads for the fair's main buildings. Burnham ordered his key contractors, including Agnew and Company, erecting the manufacturer's building, to stop work immediately. For months, Burnham had been combating rumors that he had forced his men to work at too fast a pace, with the result that buildings were unsafe. In Europe, some press reports held that buildings had been condemned. Now, here was Gottlieb, conceding a potentially catastrophic error. Gottlieb protested that even without an explicit calculation of wind loads, the buildings were strong enough. "I could not, however, take this view," Burnham wrote in a letter to James Dredge, editor of the influential British magazine Engineering. Burnham ordered all designs strengthened to withstand the highest winds recorded over the previous 10 years. "This may be going to extremes," he told Dredge, "but to me it seems wise and prudent in view of the great interests involved." Gottlieb resigned. Burnham replaced him with Edward Shankland, an engineer from his own firm who possessed a national reputation as a designer of bridges. On November 24, 1891, Burnham wrote to James Dredge to report that once again he was under fire over the issue of structural integrity. "The criticism now," he wrote, "is that the structures are unnecessarily strong." Bloom arrived in Chicago and quickly discovered why so little had been accomplished at the Midway Plaisance, known officially as Department M. Until now, it had been under the control of Frederick Putnam, a Harvard professor of ethnology. He was a distinguished anthropologist, but putting him in charge of the Midway, Bloom said years later, was about as intelligent a decision as it would be today to make Albert Einstein manager of the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. Putnam would not have disagreed. He told a Harvard colleague he was anxious to get this whole Indian circus off my hands. Bloom took his concerns to Exposition President Baker, who turned him over to Burnham. "You are a very young man, a very young man indeed, to be in charge of the work entrusted to you," Burnham said. But Burnham himself had been young when John B. Sherman walked into his office and changed his life. "I want you to know that you have my full confidence," he said. "You are in complete charge of the Midway. Go ahead with the work. You are responsible only to me. I will write orders to that effect. Good luck." By December 1891, the two buildings farthest along were the Mines and Mining Building and the Woman's Building. Construction on the Mining Building had gone smoothly, thanks to a winter that by Chicago standards had been mercifully benign. Construction of the Woman's Building, however, had become an ordeal, both for Burnham and its young architect, Sophia Hayden, mainly because of modifications demanded by Bertha Honoré Palmer, head of the fair's Board of Lady Managers, which governed all things at the fair having to do with women. As the wife of Potter Palmer, she was accustomed by wealth and absolute social dominance to having her own way, as she had made clear earlier in the year when she suppressed a revolt led by the board's executive secretary that had caused open warfare between factions of elegantly coiffed and dressed women. In the thick of it, one horrified lady manager had written to Mrs. Palmer, "I do hope that Congress will not become disgusted with our sex." Hayden came to Chicago to produce final drawings, then returned home, leaving their execution to Burnham. Construction began July 9th. Workers began applying the final coat of staff in October. Hayden returned in December to direct the decoration of the building's exterior, believing this to be her responsibility. She discovered that Bertha Palmer had other ideas. In September, without Hayden's knowledge, Palmer had invited women everywhere to donate architectural ornaments for the building, and in response had received a museum's worth of columns, panels, sculpted figures, window grills, doors, and other objects. Palmer believed the building could accommodate all the contributions, especially those sent by prominent women. Hayden, on the other hand, knew that such a hodgepodge of materials would result in an aesthetic abomination. When an influential Wisconsin woman named Flora Ginty sent an elaborately carved wooden door, Hayden turned it down. Ginty was hurt and angry. "When I think of the days I worked and the miles I traveled to achieve these things for the Woman's Building, my ire rises a little yet." Mrs. Palmer was in Europe at the time, but her private secretary, Laura Hayes, a gossip of virtuosic scope, made sure her employer learned all the details. Hayes also relayed to Palmer a few words of advice that she herself had given the architect. "I think it would be better to have the building look like a patchwork quilt than to refuse these things which the lady managers have been to such pains in soliciting." A patchwork quilt was not what Hayden had in mind. Despite Mrs. Palmer's blinding social glare, Hayden continued to decline donations. A battle followed, fought in true Gilded Age fashion with oblique snubs and poisonous courtesy. Mrs. Palmer pecked and pestered and catapulted icy smiles into Hayden's deepening gloom. Finally, Palmer assigned the decoration of the Woman's Building to someone else, a designer named Candace Wheeler. Hayden fought the arrangement in her quiet, stubborn way until she could take it no longer. She walked into Burnham's office, began to tell him her story, and promptly, literally, went mad. Tears, heaving sobs, cries of anguish, all of it. A severe breakdown, an acquaintance called it, with a violent attack of high nervous excitement of the brain. Burnham, stunned, summoned one of the exposition surgeons. Hayden was discreetly driven from the park in one of the fair's innovative English ambulances, with quiet rubber tires, and placed in a sanitarium for a period of enforced rest. She lapsed into melancholia, a sweet name for depression. At Jackson Park, aggravation was endemic. Simple matters, Burnham found, often became imbroglios. Even Olmsted had become an irritant. He was brilliant and charming, but once fixed on a thing, he was as unyielding as a slab of Joliet limestone. By the end of 1891, the question of what kind of boat to allow on the fair's waterways had come to obsess him, as if boats alone would determine the success of his quest for poetic mystery. In December 1891, Burnham received a proposal from a tugboat manufacturer, arguing the case for steam launches at the exposition. Olmsted got wind of it from Harry Codman, who, in addition to being his chief operating man in Chicago, served as a kind of spy, keeping Olmsted abreast of all threats to Olmsted's vision. Codman sent Olmsted a copy of the letter, adding his own note that the tugboat maker seemed to enjoy Burnham's confidence. On December 23rd, Olmsted wrote to Burnham, "I suspect that even Codman is inclined to think that I make too much of a hobby of this boat question and give an amount of worry, if not thought, to it that would be better expended on other and more critical matters, and I fear that you may think me a crank upon it." He proceeded, however, to vent his obsession yet again. The tugmaker's letter, he complained, framed the boat question solely in terms of moving the greatest number of passengers between different points at the exposition as cheaply and quickly as possible. "You perfectly well know that the main object to be accomplished was nothing of this sort. I need not try to make a statement of what it was. You are as alive to it as I am. You know that it was a poetic object, and you know that if boats are to be introduced on these waters, it would be perfect nonsense to have them of a kind that would antagonize this poetic object." Mere transportation was never the goal, he fumed. The whole point of having boats was to enhance the landscape. Put in the waters unbecoming boats, and the effect would be utterly disgusting, destroying the value of what would otherwise be the most valuable original feature of this exposition. I say destroy deliberately. 1,000 times better to have no boats. Despite increasing committee interference and intensified conflict between Burnham and Director General Davis, and with the threat of labor strikes ever present, the main buildings rose. Workers laid foundations of immense timbers in crisscrossed layers in accord with Root's grillage principle, then used steam-powered derricks to raise the tall posts of iron and steel that formed each building's frame. They cocooned the frames in scaffolds of wood and faced each frame with hundreds of thousands of wood planks to create walls capable of accepting 2 thick layers of staff. As workers piled mountains of fresh lumber beside each building, jagged foothills of sawdust and scrap rose nearby. The air smelled of cut wood and Christmas. In December, the exposition experienced its first death. A man named Mueller at the mines building, dead of a fractured skull. 3 other deaths followed in short order. Jansen, fractured skull, electricity building. Allard, fractured skull, electricity building. Algier, stunned to oblivion by a new phenomenon, electric shock at the mines building. Dozens of lesser accidents occurred as well. Publicly, Burnham struck a pose of confidence and optimism. In a December 28, 1891 letter to the editor of the Chicago Herald, he wrote, "A few questions of design and plan are still undetermined, but there is nothing which is not well in hand, and I see no reason why we will not be able to complete our work in time for the ceremonies in October 1892, Dedication Day, and for the opening of the exposition, May 1st, 1893. In fact, the fair was clearly behind schedule, with worse delay forestalled only by the unexpectedly mild winter. The October dedication was to take place inside the manufacturer's building, yet as of January only the foundation of the building had been laid. For the fair to be even barely presentable in time for the ceremony, everything would have to go perfectly. The weather especially would have to cooperate. Meanwhile, banks and companies were failing across America. Strikes threatened everywhere, and cholera had begun a slow white trek across Europe, raising fears that soon the first plague ships would arrive in New York Harbor. As if anyone needed extra pressure, the New York Times warned, "The failure of the fair, or anything short of a positive and pronounced success, would be a discredit to the whole country, and not to Chicago alone." Remains of the day. In November 1891, Julia Connor announced to Holmes she was pregnant. Now, she told him, he had no choice but to marry her. Holmes reacted to her news with calm and warmth. He held her, stroked her hair, and with moist eyes assured her that she had nothing to worry about. Certainly he would marry her, as he long had promised. There was, however, a condition that he now felt obligated to impose. The child was out of the question. He would marry her only if she agreed to allow him to execute a simple abortion. He was a physician. He had done it before. He would use chloroform, and she would feel nothing and awaken to the prospect of a new life as Mrs. H. H. Holmes. Children would come later. Right now, there was far too much to do, especially given all the work that lay ahead to complete the hotel and furnish each of its rooms in time for the World's Fair. Holmes knew he possessed great power over Julia. First, there was the power that accrued to him naturally through his ability to bewitch men and women alike with false candor and warmth. Second, the power of social approbation that he now focused upon her. Though sexual liaisons were common, society tolerated them only as long as their details remained secret. Packing house princes ran off with parlor maids, and bank presidents seduced typewriters. When necessary, their attorneys arranged quiet solo voyages to Europe, to the surgical suites of discreet but capable doctors. A public pregnancy, without marriage, meant disgrace and destitution. Holmes possessed Julia now as fully as if she were an antebellum slave, and he reveled in his possession. The operation, he told Julia, would take place on Christmas Eve. Snow fell. Carolers moved among the mansions on Prairie Avenue, pausing now and then to enter the fine houses for hot mulled cider and cocoa. The air was scented with wood smoke and roasting duck. In Graceland Cemetery to the north, young couples raced their sleighs over the snow-heaped undulations, pulling their blankets especially tight as they passed the tall, gloomy guardian at the tomb of Dexter Graves. Eternal silence. A hooded figure with only darkness where the face should have been. To look into this emptiness, legend held, was to receive a glimpse into the underworld. At 701 63rd Street in Englewood, Julia Connor put her daughter to bed and did her best to smile and indulge the child's delighted anticipation of Christmas. Yes, St. Nicholas would come, and he would bring wonderful things. Holmes had promised a bounty of toys and sweets for Pearl, and for Julia, something truly grand, beyond anything she could have received from her poor, bland Ned. Outside, the snow muffled the concussion of passing horses. Trains bearing fangs of ice tore through the crossing at Wallace. Julia walked down the hall to an apartment occupied by Mr. and Mrs. John Crowe. Julia and Mrs. Crowe had become friends, and now Julia helped Mrs. Crowe decorate a Christmas tree in the Crowe's apartment, meant for Pearl as a Christmas morning surprise. Julia talked of all that she and Pearl would do the next day, and told Mrs. Crowe that soon she would be going to Davenport, Iowa, to attend the wedding of an older sister. An old maid, Mrs. Crowe said, who to everyone's surprise was about to marry a railroad man. Julia was awaiting the rail pass that the groom was supposed to have put in the mail. Julia left the apartment late that night in good spirits, Mrs. Crowe later recalled. There was nothing about her conversation that would lead any of us to think she intended going away that night. Holmes offered Julia a cheerful Merry Christmas and gave her a hug, then took her hand and led her to a room on the second floor that he had readied for the operation. A table lay draped in white linen. His surgical kits stood open and gleaming, his instruments laid out in a sunflower of polished steel. Fearful things. Bone saws, abdomen retractor, trocar and trepan. More instruments, certainly, than he really needed, and all positioned so that Julia could not help but see them and be sickened by their hard, eager gleam. He wore a white apron and had rolled back his cuffs. Possibly he wore his hat, a bowler. He had not washed his hands, nor did he wear a mask. There was no need. She reached for his hand. There would be no pain, he assured her. She would awaken as healthy as she was now, but without the encumbrance she bore within. He pulled the stopper from a dark amber bottle of liquid and immediately felt its silvery exhalation in his own nostrils. He poured the chloroform into a bunched cloth. She gripped his hand more tightly, which he found singularly arousing. He held the cloth over her nose and mouth. Her eyes fluttered and rolled upward. Then came the inevitable, reflexive disturbance of muscles, like a dream of running. She released his hand, cast it away with splayed fingers. Her feet trembled as if tapping to a wildly beating drum. His own excitement rose. She tried to pull his hand away, but he was prepared for this sudden surge of muscle stimulation that always preceded stupor, and with great force clamped the cloth to her face. She beat at his arms. Slowly the energy left her, and her hands began to move in slow arcs, soothing and sensuous, the wild drums silent. Ballet now. A pastoral exit. He kept one hand on the cloth and with the other dribbled more of the liquid between his fingers into its folds, delighting in the sensation of frost where the chloroform coated his fingers. One of her wrists sagged to the table, followed shortly by the other. Her eyelids stuttered, then closed. Holmes did not think her so clever as to feign coma, but he held tight just the same. After a few moments, he reached for her wrist and felt her pulse fade to nothing, like the rumble of a receding train. He removed the apron and rolled down his sleeves. The chloroform and his own intense arousal made him feel lightheaded. The sensation, as always, was pleasant and induced in him a warm languor, like the feeling he got after sitting too long in front of a hot stove. He stoppered the chloroform, found a fresh cloth, and walked down the hall to Pearl's room. It took only a moment to bunch the fresh cloth and douse it with chloroform. In the hall afterward, he examined his watch and saw that it was Christmas. The day meant nothing to Holmes. The Christmas mornings of his youth had been suffocated under an excess of piety, prayer, and silence, as if a giant wool blanket had settled over the house. On Christmas morning, the crows waited for Julia and Pearl in glad anticipation of watching the girls' eyes ignite upon spotting the lovely tree and the presents arrayed under its boughs. The apartment was warm, the air rouged with cinnamon and fir. An hour passed. The crows waited as long as they could, but at 10 o'clock they set out to catch a train for central Chicago, where they planned to visit friends. They left the apartment unlocked, with a cheerful note of welcome. The crows returned at 11 o'clock that night and found everything as they had left it, with no evidence that Julia and her daughter had come. The next morning they tried Julia's apartment, but no one answered. They asked neighbors inside and outside the building if any had seen Julia or Pearl, but none had. When Holmes next appeared, Mrs. Crow asked him where Julia might be. He explained that she and Pearl had gone to Davenport earlier than expected. Mrs. Crow heard nothing more from Julia. She and her neighbors thought the whole thing very odd. They all agreed that the last time anyone had seen Julia or Pearl was Christmas Eve. This was not precisely accurate. Others did see Julia again, although by then no one, not even her own family back in Davenport, Iowa, could have been expected to recognize her. Just after Christmas, Holmes asked one of his associates, Charles Chappell, to come to his building. Holmes had learned that Chappell was an articulator, meaning he had mastered the art of stripping the flesh from human bodies and reassembling or articulating the bones to form complete skeletons for display in doctors' offices and laboratories. He had acquired the necessary techniques while articulating cadavers for medical students at Cook County Hospital. During his own medical education, Holmes had seen firsthand how desperate schools were to acquire corpses, whether freshly dead or skeletonized. The serious, systematic study of medicine was intensifying, and to scientists, the human body was like the polar ice cap, something to be studied and explored. Skeletons hung in doctors' offices where they served as visual encyclopedias. With demand outpacing supply, doctors established a custom of graciously and discreetly accepting any offered cadaver. They frowned on murder as a means of harvest. On the other hand, they made little effort to explore the provenance of any one body. Grave robbing became an industry, albeit a small one, requiring an exceptional degree of sang-froid. In periods of acute shortage, doctors themselves helped mine the newly departed. It was obvious to Holmes that even now, in the 1890s, demand remained high. Chicago's newspapers reported ghoulish tales of doctors raiding graveyards. After a foiled raid on a graveyard in New Albany, Indiana, on February 24, 1890, Dr. W. H. Wathen, head of the Kentucky Medical College, told a Tribune reporter, "The gentlemen were acting not for the Kentucky School of Medicine, nor for themselves individually, but for the medical schools of Louisville, to which the human subject is as necessary as breath to life." Just 3 weeks later, the physicians of Louisville were at it again. They attempted to rob a grave at the State Asylum for the Insane in Anchorage, Kentucky, this time on behalf of the University of Louisville. "Yes, the party was sent out by us," a senior school official said. "We must have bodies, and if the state won't give them to us, we must steal them." The winter classes were large and used up so many subjects that there are none for the spring classes. He saw no need to apologize. "The asylum cemetery has been robbed for years," he said, "and I doubt if there is a corpse in it. I tell you, we must have bodies. You cannot make doctors without them, and the public must understand it. If we can't get them any other way, we will arm the students with Winchester rifles and send them to protect the body snatchers on their raids." Holmes had an eye for opportunity, and with demand for corpses so robust, opportunity now beckoned. He showed Charles Chapel into a second-floor room that contained a table, medical instruments, and bottles of solvents. These did not trouble Chapel, nor did the corpse on the table, for Chapel knew that Holmes was a physician. The body was clearly that of a woman, although of unusual height. He saw nothing to indicate her identity. The body, he said, looked like that of a jackrabbit, which had been skinned by splitting the skin down the face and rolling it back off the entire body. In some places, considerable of the flesh had been taken off with it. Holmes explained that he had been doing some dissection, but now had completed his research. He offered Chapel $36 to cleanse the bones and skull and return to him a fully articulated skeleton. Chapel agreed. Holmes and Chapel placed the body in a trunk lined with duck cloth. An express company delivered it to Chapel's house. Soon afterward, Chapel returned with the skeleton. Holmes thanked him, paid him, and promptly sold the skeleton to Hahnemann Medical College, the Chicago school, not the Philadelphia school of the same name, for many times the amount he had paid Chapel. In the second week of January, 1892, new tenants, the Doyle family, moved into Julia's quarters in Holmes's building. They found dishes on the table and Pearl's clothes hung over a chair. The place looked and felt as if the former occupants planned to return within minutes. The Doyles asked Holmes what had happened. With his voice striking the perfect sober note, Holmes apologized for the disarray and explained that Julia's sister had fallen gravely ill, and Julia and her daughter had left at once for the train station. There was no need to pack up their belongings, as Julia and Pearl were well provided for and would not be coming back. Later, Holmes offered a different story about Julia. I last saw her about January 1st, 1892, when a settlement of her rent was made. At this time, she had announced not only to me, but to her neighbors and friends, that she was going away. Although she had told everyone her destination was Iowa, in fact, Holmes said, she was going elsewhere to avoid the chance of her daughter being taken from her, giving the Iowa destination to mislead her husband. Holmes denied that he and Julia ever had engaged each other physically or that she had undergone a criminal operation, a then-current euphemism for abortion. That she is a woman of quick temper and perhaps not always of a good disposition may be true, but that any of her friends and relatives will believe her to be an amoral woman or one who would be a party to a criminal act, I do not think. A gauntlet dropped. 1892 broke cold, with 6 inches of snow on the ground and temperatures falling to 10 degrees below zero. Certainly not the coldest weather Chicago ever experienced, but cold enough to clot the valves of all 3 of the city water system's intake valves and temporarily halt the flow of Chicago's drinking water. Despite the weather, work at Jackson Park progressed. Workers erected a heated, movable shelter that allowed them to apply staff to the exterior of the mines and mining building no matter what the temperature. The woman's building was nearly done, all its scaffolding gone. The giant manufacturer's building had begun rising above its foundation. In all, the workforce in the park numbered 4,000. The ranks included a carpenter and furniture maker named Elias Disney, who in coming years would tell many stories about the construction of this magical realm beside the lake. His son Walt would take note. Beyond the exposition's 8-foot fence and its 2 tiers of barbed wire, there was tumult. Wage reductions and layoffs stoked unrest among workers nationwide. Unions gained strength. The Pinkerton National Detective Agency gained revenue. A rising union man named Samuel Gompers stopped by Burnham's office to discuss allegations that the exposition discriminated against union workers. Burnham ordered his construction superintendent, Dion Geraldine, to investigate. As labor strife increased and the economy faltered, the general level of violence rose. In taking stock of 1891, the Chicago Tribune reported that 5,906 people had been murdered in America, nearly 40% more than in 1890. The increase included Mr. and Mrs. Borden of Fall River, Massachusetts. The constant threat of strike and the onset of deep cold shaded the new year for Burnham, but what most concerned him was the fast-shrinking treasury of the Exposition Company. In advancing the work so quickly and on such a grand scale, Burnham's department had consumed far more money than anyone had anticipated. There was talk now among the directors of seeking a $10 million appropriation from Congress, but the only immediate solution was to reduce expenditures. On January 6th, Burnham commanded his department chiefs to take immediate, in some cases draconian, measures to cut costs. He ordered his chief draftsman in charge of exposition work underway in the attic of the rookery to fire at once any man who did inaccurate or slouchy work, or who failed to do more than his full duty. He wrote to Olmsted's landscape superintendent, Rudolf Ulrich, "It seems to me you can now cut your force down one half, and at the same time let very many expensive men go." Henceforth, Burnham ordered, all carpentry work was to be done only by men employed by the fair's contractors. To Geraldine, he wrote, "You will please dismiss every carpenter on your force." Until this point, Burnham had shown a level of compassion for his workers that was extraordinary for the time. He paid them even when illness or injury kept them out of work and established an exposition hospital which provided free medical care. He built quarters within the park where they received 3 large meals a day and slept in clean beds and well-heated rooms. A Princeton professor of political economy named Walter Wyckoff disguised himself as an unskilled laborer, and spent a year traveling and working among the nation's growing army of unemployed men, including a stint at Jackson Park. Guarded by sentries and high barriers from unsought contact with all beyond, great gangs of us.